Hey everyone, Aaron Noonan here. Welcome to the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Repco. This is part two of our chat with Adrian Burgess. Of course, these days is head of motorsport of the Repco Supercars Championship. We had such a great chat recently that we've split it out across two parts over 2 weeks, and this is part two. If you haven't heard part one, go and have a listen to that first before you get into where this one picks up, because it will explain a lot of things. We pick up the chat here on part two in 2005 and how he very unexpectedly ended up back in Formula One. We cover off how Adrian moved to Australia to work in V8 Supercars, his time with Dick Johnson Racing and that dramatic 2010 championship win with James Courtney, his years at Triple Eight, the awkward chat with Roland Dane to tell him he was leaving for HRT, and plenty more as well. And we also cover a cause that's really close to Adrian's heart and a lot of people out there, the Tour de Cure. It's an amazing thing, and Adrian and I have a talk about that as well. Adrian tackles the National Motor Racing Museum couch racer questions and the V8 Sleuth Top 10 shootout as well. So here we go. Buckle up. Time to start part two of my chat with Adrian Burgess on the V8 Sleuth podcast, powered by Repco.
How did you end up dragged back into Formula One? Was it Carlin's involvement with, because Eddie Jordan sold Jordan, was that how that all, he sort of went, I need some help, mate, come on in?
Oh, it was a little bit like that. Bernie Eccleston pushed, sort of, so in 03, a guy called Alex Schneider and Colin Collas got introduced to Trevor. They wanted to set a Formula One team up. So I was, at that point, I'd stopped Formula 3 and I'd set up Trevor's World Series Renault team. So I was team manager and engineer in that with Thiago Monteiro and Olivier Plar, I think, that year. Or Moraine, I can't remember which way around. But anyway, I was running the World Series Renault team. And then Trevor said, right, okay. I was really the only one there with any degree of Formula 1 knowledge at the time. He said, right, there's a Russian guy wants to set up a Formula One team from the ground up.
I heard that before. Heard that a few times over the years.
Sam brought up those corny stories, didn't it? But so we meet Alex Snyder and Colin, and they, so they give us this brief, and obviously Trevor dealt with the budget side of it. But Trevor said, okay, so you're doing the World Series Renault. In the background, I want you to start talking to Dallara. I want you to start talking engines. I want you to put a team profile together of the amount of staff you need and roles and descriptions and payroll, and equally go and find a facility. So that's actually another strange story, which I'm going to diverse a little bit here.
Yeah, go for it.
That's how I found out Ben Collins was the Stig.
Oh, do tell. This sounds good.
I was down at, not Bruntingthorpe, just outside Guildford, where the runway is. What's the name of it?
The test track that they used to
use. Oh, God, it's going to destroy me now. They used to make the Harrier jump jet there for the English, the aircraft. Anyway, I was down there looking at these military buildings, hangars and stuff, to put the Formula One team, put Midland Formula One in there. And I'm just driving out of there, and I see Ben's car. And he still had the little Carlin sticker on the back of it. So I ring him up. I said, hey, geezer. Because his nickname was Geezer. I said, what are you doing? He said, oh, I'm up in London. And I knew that Top Gear filmed down there. So I knew it was Top Gear used. What's the name of that place? Dunsfield Park. So I knew Top Gear were there filming. And I ring him up. He said, oh, no, I'm just up in London. I'm having a business meeting. I said, no, you're not. I said, because I'm stood at the back of your car. He said, what are you doing? He says, oh, just stay there. I'll come out and talk to you. And then the Stig walked over, and he's in the full white outfit. He's got the balaclava on. A normal person wouldn't know who he is, but I only knew him. Yeah, you know the way he walks, and you work with him for a while. And he comes over, and I'm standing there chatting to him for 15 minutes, and he's got his balaclava on. I said, geezer, take your balaclava off. He said, I can't. He said, if anyone sees me and sees that I'm sort of showing my face to someone, he says, they'll see me. I said, man, I've known you too long. And it was like, we stood there having this conversation for 20 minutes with me in a full balaclava. It was like really surreal. But anyway, so that's how I found out he was Stig.
Love it.
Anyway, we digress. So 2003 and 4, we're putting this team together. We'd gone and done a deal with Dallara to design the car for us. I was putting a factory together. We were still a year away. We weren't meant to race this thing until 2006. And then It's probably late January 2005. Trevor rings me up on a Sunday night. He said, "ATB, put your suit on, be at my house 7 o'clock in the morning." He said, we're going out. I said, "Okay, no worries." Didn't tell me where, whatever. I turn up at Trev's house. We jump in his car, straight up the M40 to Silverstone. We pull up at Jordan. I said, "Mate, what's going on?" He said, "You're now the team manager. We've just bought the place." I'm like, "You what?" And by the way, the first Grand Prix is in 6 weeks. I'm like, you're kidding me. And we get there and Colin Collas is there and Trevor and myself, and we basically walk in and everyone's been assembled on the shop floor, and Eddie Jordan's there and he's like, "Oh yeah, guys, yeah, I've just sold the team and this is your new boss." I'm like, and Trevor's like, "Yeah, we're in Brazil in 6 weeks." I'm like, "Oh my God." You know, it was just incredible. It was absolutely crazy, mind numbing, just thrown in at the deep end, you know. So basically Bernie had realized that Eddie Jordan was going under, and just he was going to bail on the team because he'd had enough of it, and he'd got hold of Alex Snyder, and because we'd already put an entry in, we'd actually paid the money to buy our own entry. So basically he just shoehorned Alex and the deal there into Jordan to keep Jordan going. So that's how I sort of ended up back in Formula One. It was quite entertaining.
And that 2005 year, probably for a lot of our listeners, is the what a year for you to go there, because that's the year of the infamous US Grand Prix where the Michelin runners all bailed, and it was a six-car race between the Bridgestone shod, two Ferraris, two Jordans, two Minardis, and yeah. You get it was Thiago Monteiro, wasn't it, who got on the podium. You thought the start of the year was surreal? How was being in Indianapolis that day in 05 as surreal?
It was crazy. It was very crazy. So, I mean, on the Friday, you could see straight away. I think Ralph stuck it in the wall.
Yeah.
Had a big one. And maybe Diano Trulli, I can't remember. But there was a couple of big accidents. And you pretty well knew straight away they were in trouble with their tyres. So we just kept on. We just kept doing our job. We were, in those days, we were struggling. We were down the back of the grid. We didn't have any money. We had two great guys. We had Narain and Thiago, who we'd both worked with in World Series Renault. They'd both driven for us the previous year. So we knew the drivers. That was the easy part. But we were making up the numbers, to be brutally honest. It was, you know, and that's what I go back to saying earlier on in the piece about working in teams when you know you don't have a chance of winning is quite mentally quite hard. And we were all just getting through it, getting through the year, getting through the job, trying to improve everything we could with what we had, the budget we had. But when there's a big team owners meeting, so we all get pulled in with Bernie on the Sunday morning. We'd had rumours and stories of it Saturday night, but then Sunday morning, Bernie pulls us all into the office, and you know, basically the Michelin team say, "Well, we're going to go to the grid," and then we're coming down into the pit lane. We weren't quite sure whether that had happened or not, but we were just told, "Just carry on, do your own job, do our job." So we went to the grid with everybody, and then we set off on the formation lap, and they all peel in the pit lane, and we arrive on the grid. It was like, "Oh my God." And then the crowd just went crazy.
In a bad way, not a good way.
In a bad way, 100% in a bad way. You know, it's park the fact that we had a podium, and it's the only time Thiago is up on a podium, and you know, part of the fact that the team was, you know, overjoyed. The third and the fourth was incredible for our little team, but just for the event and for the sport and for the fans, it was a shit show, to be honest. It wasn't fun at all. You know, driving out the gate at night, and we're legging it for the airport, and there's all the fans there, and rightly so. They're like, "You know, give us our money back," and you know, grabbing the bus and rocking the bus over. It's just bad. You know, you don't ever want to be involved in things like that. It's not good for anyone.
No, it was a weird, strange day. And Formula One in America really didn't recover for a long time, probably not till COTA came along. But were there any other moments? I guess you've traveled a lot around the world, particularly with F1, but also in your supercars era. Is there any time that a travel has had any weird or strange or dangerous positions? We hear stories all the time about F1 in Brazil and things like that. Did you ever find yourself in all that travel in a dodgy or a difficult situation somewhere along the line?
Yeah, I mean, Brazil, you mentioned it, is always a tough one. I mean, you know, we were kids, and I think that year actually we were there with the six cars, you have a good fun. It's a great atmosphere. You do get up to a bit of mischief. We were driving the combis. Yeah, everyone had the old combi vans. And the first thing you do at the airport when you pick it up is turn the water jets, you know, out to the side, and then re-plumb it so you can actually top the water bottle up from inside the van because you'd go through so much water. So driving down the main road, you're like, you know, whoever's driving, and I didn't drive then, but you're sort of pushing the wipers and squirting everyone with water. Well, we came up alongside this truck with all these sort of mangoes, melons or whatever they were in the back of it, and there's a couple of kids there sat in the back on top of the melons. It's straight out of a movie, you know. And we went past them with the old water going straight out, soaking them. And then they pulled up alongside us at the traffic lights and they just pull out a piece. All of a sudden you got a Smith & Wesson pointing at you. Oh, whatever it was.
I thought you were going to say they threw some mangoes at you.
No. They just pulled a gun on us. So, wow. You know, you're like, I don't know why you do it, but you wind the window up. Not that that's going to help you very much. But like everyone's ducking for cover and like, shit, we're not doing that again. Yeah, so luckily they just let us go. But you always actually had to drive into the circuit there, and we weren't allowed to go in team kit because it's the town, the village there outside the track is fairly rough, and there's a lot of poverty going on there. And countless times teams were held at gunpoint, and people handing briefcases and watches and wallets and things out the window. So that, yeah, there's been times that it's not been that great, and it's sad. I think when you go to places like that, you've got a great racetrack, but then just outside it, you've got all this poverty going on. And that was actually one of the great things about Ayrton. Ayrton understood that and knew that, and he was so passionate about being a Brazilian, but trying to do everything he could for his fellow countrymen. And, you know, he never once, you know, whilst he had all the trappings in life and the success, he always did what he could for those guys that aren't quite as haven't had the lucky life that he had. So he was very respectful and put a lot of money into those sort of charities, and that, you know, the Senna Foundation is still there today doing a lot of great work for those sort of people. So that was such a contrast between being in the circuit and everyone's walking around in Rolexes, and just outside the gate you're being robbed. So yeah, it's weird. It's a bit of a it's quite a moral dilemma that you'd lived. You were lucky to be, and I consider myself lucky to be, you know, going around the world with those guys doing that stuff. You forget, you know, there's normal people out there, and you know, life can be quite hard and hard for people. So yeah, it brought you back down to earth.
Yeah, there's F1 world and then there's real world. There's a big chasm between the two. The Jordan thing unrolls in 2005. I think it was renamed Midland the next year, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Thereabouts.
Yeah.
So when did and how did the whole Adrian to Australia thing start? What was the catalyst to get you here, and how did you land at Dick Johnson Racing and end up out of Formula One again?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'd sort of been to Oz, obviously, you know, numerous times throughout the 90s, and I mean, I've always had a great time here, you know, racing in Adelaide and seeing the V8s there, you know, not at the time, you don't realise what's going to happen in your life 15 years later or whatever, but always had a great time coming here. I had family here, you know, my sister was already living here, and what basically happened is Trevor, it all became a bit too much for Trevor. He was still running Carlin. So Trevor was the sporting director, I was the team manager. And then halfway through 05, Trevor said, "Right, I'm out. I'm going back to Carlin. Here you go. Here's the keys." So then they made me sporting director. To be honest, it felt the same job as when I was team manager, but there was just even more responsibility, you know, looking after 270, 280 people. And I've just found myself, you know, you go away, you do 6 weeks, you do 4 Grand Prix, 6 weeks without even coming home. And then when I was home, you know, you'd race on a Sunday at a Grand Prix, you'd be, you know, I wasn't down on the ground anymore with a mechanic, so I'd be straight out of there on a plane. Sounds great. But then 8 o'clock the next morning, I was back in the office at Silverstone, and my house, my bed to my desk was 100 miles, 160 kilometers.
Oof.
So I found myself doing all the races. Monday morning, 8 o'clock, I'd be back behind my desk. All week, you'd work in your, you know, you're behind off, and I don't mind work. That's never been an issue, but I found myself, I ended up having to stay up in Silverstone, you know, two nights a week because I was driving home 7-8 o'clock at night and I would be falling asleep. And it was only the rumble strips, you know, the side of the motorway waking me up before I hit the Armico. And it's just so many times I'm like, this is going to kill me if I'm not careful. And I was sort of becoming ill. My daughter Darcy was six at the time, six or seven. Every time I came home, she was like a half inch taller and doing things. You're missing out on so much life, yeah. And so much of your family life. And, you know, you're working your behind off. Okay, you got looked after and the trappings were good and all those things. But I got to that point where life wasn't all about racing. Much as I loved racing and I was never going to do anything different, I realized I was going to put myself into an early grave. And it was just becoming too much. It wasn't healthy. And that year, 2006, a Melbourne Grand Prix, was just when they started the new Parc Fermé rules. So you actually gave your cars back to the FIA like 6:30 in the evening. Anyway, before I came, JC's on the phone because I hadn't seen him for a couple of years. He invited me down at the start of the year for his wedding, but I couldn't do it because of work. And anyway, he's pestering me. We've got to catch up. We've got to have dinner. So I said, Saturday night, you know, we give the cars back at 6:30. Let's have dinner Saturday night. We go and have dinner. And JC brings along Stevie Johnson. And I didn't know who Steve was at the time. Obviously, I'd heard of his father and who Dick was. And we had a nice dinner, a lovely evening, do the race, go back home, back to Europe. Life carries on. And then about three or four races later, so a couple of months later, JC texts me or rings me, says, I remember that guy we had dinner with. I said, yeah. So, well, they've got a job. They're looking for a team manager. I said, what do you think? And he must have just called me right on one of those days where you're just over it. And you're like knackered and you nearly killed yourself in the car on the way home and all this sort of stuff. And I got home, said to Jean, my wife, I said, yeah, JC just called and said, there's a job going. What do you reckon? And she said, do it. She says, just go and talk to him. So I don't know. He got me a weak moment. I picked a bit in between races, jumped on a plane, ended up going to Perth for a weekend. Had a sort of interview, and I sort of knew the series because I'd seen them enough, you know, and I knew enough about Australia. My sister was in Sydney, and Dick couldn't make it to the race, so I caught up with Steve Chalker and just hung around at the event and just having a look and understanding it. And you can imagine going from Formula One to Perth, and that was in the old days where Perth pit lane was just a bunch of tents, you know, on the outside of the circuit. So it was like, oh my word, you know, this is the other end of the scale here. But the racing was great, and you know Lounsey and Scafie, those you knew the names. You know, you can't not know those names when you're in this industry. So I went back to Europe and said, oh, Jean, what do you reckon? She goes, do it. And I was, and to be fair, she was the one who pushed me. I was the one sat there saying, thinking, oh, my network's here and people are here. I know everyone. I'll always have a job here. And if I go there, what's going to happen? And, you know, I was the nervous one. And she said, Darcy's 6 years old. If we're going to go, now's the time. And we thought, sod it. Let's give it a crack. So came down here as a sporting director and jumped into DJR. And, that's, you know, we had Will and, you know, and I'd sort of known Will a little bit from Formula 3 days, you know, in Europe. So, time to make a change and go and have a look.
Oh, well, it's worked because you're still having a look. We haven't got rid of you. You're still here.
A few people tried.
We'll talk about that soon.
Please don't go there.
DJR was a tough time at DJR because the glory years of the Shell money had disappeared. Things were a bit difficult. Did you know what you got yourself in for? Or did you start to realize after a while, wow, we're actually not flush with sponsors here. This is a tough grind. And even when the Jim Beam stuff came along, it probably looked a little bit better than it was.
Oh, like every good salesman, old Chalks didn't really show his full deck of cards. And I thought I'd pick the ace and thought, yeah, this looks good. But no, when I got here and actually got my feet under the table and understood more about the team and what was going on, you quickly realize, oh my word, this is going to be a challenge. But I've never been afraid of a challenge. I'd love a challenge, and that was one hell of a challenge. But you got there and, you know, you're embraced by Dick and Jill and the guys, and I had and still have to this day a fantastic relationship with Dick and Jill, and they really opened their arms and invited my family in, and I'll always be forever grateful for that. They made us so welcome and helped in our sort of transition away from sort of security and life as we knew it in Europe to coming down here and going racing. So for me, it was a start of something great. You know, you felt like you'd actually could do something and put your own little mark on it, as opposed to being a small cog in a huge wheel in Europe when you're sort of a number. Yes, you had a responsible job and I loved my racing, but here you actually, it's a lot smaller pond here, and you could actually, you've felt like you were actually playing more of a role. And the DJR challenge was fantastic. I loved it. It was, we had some great highlights along the way.
It had culminated over 4.5 years to the championship, which we'll talk about with James Courtney, who arrived in 2009, champion in 2010. But there was a Bathurst podium with Will and Steve in 2007 in that wet race late at the end, which is some of the best wet weather late race Bathurst action, I think, on file, on tape. Will Davison had a win at Eastern Creek the next year and did a bit more winning. And I think he finished fifth or something in the championship and contended. And Stevie J was really strong. So from where it was in 06 when you turned up, the team got itself sorted out and became a contender again. But the thing that I really wanted to hone in on, and we put a call out to questions from our readers and our followers and our listeners. So many people want to know about 2010, that amazing championship win, which was really against the odds in a lot of ways. The Sydney final is kind of its own chapter. But can you just give us a bit of an insight into how that 2010 year unfolded from within the workshop at DJR? Because obviously the team owners weren't talking, Dick and Charlie Schwerkolt, things weren't great there. Lots of challenges to overcome along the way. Take us inside it all.
It's a great story, and it's something I'm proud to have been part of. It started a few years before that, as all these stories do. You know, our equipment wasn't competitive. We had great engines, always had good engines, but the chassis was lacking a little bit. There was still a few people there that were still from the old era. And, you know, when I started pushing buttons and trying to push people and bring them up to a different level, you know, you get a bit of pushback. So over the years, we brought in a lot of new people. You know, I probably pushed people a bit too hard, and the week sort of fell off, so to speak. And we started to put a really good group of people together. And part of that was equally making sure we had the right hardware. So, you know, we went and, you know, spoke to Roland and did a deal up there for some front suspension and dampers. And we didn't have their chassis at the time. But then we took the car. I took the car over to England and we put it in a wind tunnel and on a shaker rig for a couple of days. And in those days, you're allowed, before someone says you weren't.
Yes, correct.
In those days, we were allowed to do that. And we actually started making some good progress with the team. We started attracting some decent sponsors. Will was doing a great job, as you mentioned. We Eastern Creek, he had his first win and we were joint for the round. And I think that was the start of us building some momentum. And part of that process enabled us to get someone of James's caliber on board. And James was another ingredient we needed and wanted from the team to take us that next level. Then the FG came and we went and got a car from RD, stuck our engine in it, and we were just putting all those pieces together. And, you know, we knew going into that year we were never the favourite. We were a long way from the favourite, even to the last day. You know, I concentrated on trying to build a race team. We had some great engineers in Scotty and Mark, who's unfortunately no longer with us, but we had some really good people there, and we managed to build a really good culture, and it was a great team, and everyone in there was on the same page, and we changed the culture a lot, and that takes a lot to do, but it gives you results, and everyone was there for each other, and we worked so hard, and that was how, on the last day of the year sort of thing in Sydney, that's how we did what we did that day, was because of the people and the culture. Yes, we had good equipment. And I said to James at the start of the year, Days, the car's only good enough for fourth or fifth, be fourth or fifth. I don't want you trying to get third and spray it and we end up 10th. Days, you can win, you got to win. And JC did exactly that. You know, that was the year where we started with a soft, I think, and we went QR and won both, and then backed it up at Winton and won both.
Four in a row.
Yeah, and James was, he'd had a lot more experience than some of the guys here from driving in different categories and different countries around the world, different tyres, and he very quickly got his head around it, and he extracted the most out of that tyre very early on. It didn't take long for people to catch up because they're just such a great calibre of driver and engineer down here, so they caught up pretty quick, but we capitalised when it was there for us. So we were just building. We were in the hunt, and I kept trying to keep people focused and just remain in the race. And then we won in Sandown, I think, at the penultimate round, and that just gave us that chance. And then Saturday came in Sydney, and well, that's a whole different story. And it was one of my best days in motorsport.
It still gets the hair on my neck standing up because. Yeah. You will never get a situation. There's the infamous commentary line of he's in the fence, they're both in the fence, they're all in the fence, Courtney, Wincup, winner bottom. It was the script that you could write and they would have sent it back and said, that is bullshit. We're never making that because it will never happen. And it happened and it became a race at 0 kilometers per hour between the pit crews to get their cars back going. You got yours out. It was pretty wonky. It didn't steer very straight. But it made it around to get some points and ultimately finish the job on the Sunday. But it's one of the biggest roars I've heard from a crowd when Courtney's wobbling down the pit lane. Your blokes have got blood up their arms. They've been throwing hot discs in. They've got stuff going everywhere. It's one of the biggest crowd roars I've heard at a supercar race ever in my life. It was an amazing day.
Oh, look, I feel honoured and proud and grateful and thankful and all of those adjectives. Just to be part of that and work with those guys. It wasn't me. It wasn't James. It was the team and it was the guys. And those guys deserve medals, in my opinion. But, again, the culture that we had, we knew we had a crack at this and we all saw it unfold and it was like, oh, my God. But we never gave in, as the two other teams didn't. But I think we made a couple of key choices, right? You know, we got the car straight in the garage where we could throw people at it. And I think Tickford or FPR at the time, you know, sat in the pit lane and tried to do it. And then you're restricted. You only had the six or seven people over the line that you could use. So we just got on with it. And Triple Eight did the same thing. But it came down to how much we all wanted it. And my guys, it was an honor to lead those blokes because they just were the difference that day. And just the will and commitment, you know, I saw them. They were just holding uprights that was just burning them, you know, just the commitment to get that thing out. And we knew the others were doing it because you could see it on the TV, the cameras, you know, in the garages. And we knew it was a race, us against them. Just get out, try and be running at the flag and just get some points because that 30, 40 points, whatever we could salvage, we knew was going to be crucial for the next day. So, and you're right. And to be honest, you know, Frank Adamson was in there and, you know, he's at one point we're ready to push it out. And look, we knew we only had to do a lap or two. So, you know, you wouldn't go and put it in the Le Mans 24 hours with that set up on the car, but we knew what it needed to do. And we knew we only needed to get out and circulate. So yeah, it wasn't perfect, but it was safe. You know, you're never going to put the guy out on the track unless it's safe. So we did what we needed to do. You know, we pushed back once and then Frank said, no, because I don't think the brake duct was connected properly to the front bar. And we pulled it back in and fixed that and then pushed him back out. And just hearing the corporate and the grandstand erupt was just incredible. And my wife and daughter were upstairs at the time. And just you could feel the emotion from three floors up. It was just incredible. And I remember I'm on the phone to him, the radio, as he's driving down a pit lane, just be careful. Don't do anything silly. Just circulate, you know. And all this is going on. And poor old Webby was having the drive of his life in that wet race. And so our other car, Jono Webb, you know, he won the race outright. And so all this was going on. And then the flag dropped. And then we realized Webby had won. And then JC wobbles around and Jamie's just caught him up. So they're on track against each other again. And we looked at the monitors and realized we were classified and we realized he wasn't. And it was like, oh my word. You know, it was like we'd won the championship that day. And, you know, the next day was hard enough already, but that was just such a big day. It was, yeah, I think everybody, you know, will remember that day and rightly so. It was amazing and just incredible to be part of it. That was the result of 5 years for me of hard work, putting a great team together, fantastic people, all aligned, all with the same passion, all with the energy to get it done. And that was what you can do if you believe. Yeah, mm. it was amazing. It's still good today.
Oh, I think there's a doco in that weekend, and particularly on that Saturday, it was a stunning result. And I mentioned it earlier. You really had to galvanize your team, your engineers, your mechanics, the other staff. Meanwhile, you've got this difficult situation in the level above you, where Dick and Charlie are clearly heading for divorce, and it's not fun and it's not nice, and it's in the media and people are reporting things. But I guess for you, you're just trying to keep your guys in the zone, worry about the race car, push all that stuff aside.
It's hard, part of my role there. I mean, I had a great relationship with Dick and Charlie. I still do to this day. But my role there was protecting my people and trying to keep them all focused. And I mean, I'd even, the whole Dick and Charlie thing was crazy. Whether people want to agree, we had a really good team there, and Jim Beam were on board. We had a great driver. We were kicking goals, and it's a shame it ended as it did, because it all sort of disintegrated and a lot of people left. I think we're all a little bit disheartened that, the effort we'd put in didn't come to nothing. We won ourselves a championship, so we'll always be grateful for that. But we knew there could have been so much more, and it was a little bit disappointing going to the last race knowing that, Dick and Charlie were toe-to-toe with each other, and we couldn't afford a set of brakes. I go to that last race and I'm scrounging brakes from other teams because we couldn't pay our bills. It was just crazy. It was a crazy atmosphere, and we saw all this coming. I'd already, unfortunately, I'd made the decision that, I was going to leave at the end of the year because I could just see the writing on the wall. But none of us, especially myself, I couldn't let that get in the way of me doing my job. And it made me sort of hungrier, to be honest, because I wanted to beat the bloke where I was going to. I wanted to show him, why he's hired me. So, so we're all determined as anything to still get the job done. And no one, James, he probably mentally checked out, and he, I don't know whether he knew where he was going at that point or not, but he delivered. He still did the job as every single person in that team did. So it was great for me. It was a nice personal thing, and for Dick and for Charlie, and for everyone involved, we still achieved a hell of a lot that year.
Mm. Oh, it's a very special championship win, and I think the team hadn't won for 15 years by that point. So it was a breaking of the drought, and it was we broke the drought that weekend in Sydney too, because we all got absolutely saturated. It was crazy. Triple Eight, 2011 to partway through 2013. I guess at the time the team's at the top. Wincup's winning championships like they're going out of fashion. You guys had got in the mix at DJR and broken his little run of, I think he would have had five in a row had you guys, or six in a row had you not won that one with James. Was it an offer just too good to refuse to go there? I mean, it was the benchmark team and all the things that come with it.
I think it was a bit of everything. I think I sort of realised how far you could take DJR at the time. I sort of always knew there was going to be a limit as to what you could achieve with those guys, and similar to my, what I was saying earlier about getting into Formula One, you always want to achieve, you want to push yourself, you want more responsibility, you want to learn new things and more things, whether it's about race teams or whether it's about business. And, when I came to Australia, love him or hate him, you quickly see that RD is, he's a consummate professional. He's a racer and he's a very astute businessman. And for me, I thought I can learn a lot from him. And, and enjoy doing what I do, which is going racing and challenging for race wins all the time. So, I went in there with my eyes open, and, again, we had a great group of people, and clearly we had some great success with Jamie and Craig and those guys. It was a challenge. I was pushing myself. I wanted to learn more, and I wanted to learn more about, maybe not so much about the race cars anymore, but more about the business side and the politics and getting, in the championship, and just starting to move myself forward again in a different arena. And, RD did that. And I hope that, whilst we fell out at the end, I hope he can look back and say, I did my job while I was there. The job he paid me to do, I think I did it. We were 1, 2, 3 years on the trot. We had some great success, and, I was only a small part of that, but you're still a part of it, and you still have an influence, and you still are asked to do your job day in, day out.
How'd you break the news that you were You were heading off. Everyone asked about gardening leave, by the way. I've got more gardening questions than a gardening podcast, by the way.
Yes. I'm not very good at gardening. Oh, look, it wasn't easy. I mean, I knew I was letting him down. In my own view, I thought I'm letting the guy down. He's put some faith in me, and I don't think he saw it coming. And, you know, I wasn't out there to shock anyone. But, I'd got to a point where I didn't see some of the things coming that I thought were coming or what we'd agreed, you know, 3-4 years earlier. And, you know, it was hard. It was hard decision to make because I knew I could have just carried on, you know, winning races and championships, you know. But again, I've been offered, you know, the role of as managing director of HRT. And when you look back on it, oh, they were a huge team and very prestigious and a huge amount of history. But, you know, when you look back on it, was it a good call? Who knows? You know, I don't really go around anymore. I don't have regrets. You know, I think you make decisions in life for the right reasons at the time. And I think every experience is knowledge. It's an experience. It's something you should take in life and you should get in life. And, you know, I'll be judged on, you know, on my time there. And we didn't achieve what I'd hoped we could have or would have. When I went there, for me, it was another challenge. You know, Triple Eight was a very well-oiled machine, and that wasn't because of me. That was because of all the hard work that RD and those people guys had done before I got there. I just carried it on and did my job. But, you know, the HRT era, you know, for me, it was a challenge. They were on their knees, so to speak. You know, they hadn't had the success they were accustomed to. And, you know, like I said earlier, I want to push myself and I want to try and learn and give myself a challenge. And that was one hell of a challenge. Again, probably more than I'd anticipated before I went there. And so, look, it's, you know, life, you know, you're here once. It's not a dress rehearsal. You've got to push yourself and you've got to put yourself, you know, take yourself outside your comfort zone every now and again. And you know, and I stand by that. I'm happy with the decisions I made. I might have, it's been sat in the garden for 6 months, but yeah, that's life, mate. That's how the cookie crumbles.
Yeah, I guess you make the decisions at the time based on the best info you've got and what you feel is right and what's presented to you at the time, and who knows how these things ever play out or work. I did go for a little Google before we chatted, and Roland called you a motor racing mercenary. Probably not the worst thing you've been called in your life, but
I think Ludo got worse than I did.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say, you got off lightly compared to Ludo.
We had to wait a few years for that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Hey, look, I'd have done the same thing. I would have said the same thing. I get it. You know, I get it. But it's some days it's about yourself. It's you spend all your life pleasing other people, but you got to make the decisions yourself and you got to live with them. I live with it. I stick with it. You know, we had a few frosty years. We get on all right now. We have a stoush now. I'd like to believe or hope or think that he respects me for who I am and what I do. But if he doesn't, then he doesn't. You know, I'm still going to sleep tonight. You need to move. You need to progress your career. You need to be learning. You need to be challenging yourself. You know, RD's still there now. You know, I left, I don't know, what was it, 7-8 years ago. And RD's still in the chair now. You know, I actually wanted to get in that chair, but it didn't happen. And I sort of realized that he wasn't going to step away.
And that was so, kind of the reason why you went there, the opportunity that you thought that would happen down the track? Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. You know, and they were some of the discussions were based around, you know, a contingency plan and for RD and the business. And that was one of the attractive reasons to go there. But, you know, for one reason or another, that didn't happen. Maybe I wasn't good enough. Yeah, maybe he didn't want to hand over the reins to me. It's fine. I get that. Or maybe just, you know, he's a racer. It's hard for anyone
to let go.
It's hard to let go. And so it should be. And he's created that business. And I don't blame him for sitting around longer than we'd sort of spoken about that. But that's not a criticism of him. He's put the hard yards in. This is his train set. It's not mine. I was an employee. I wasn't the owner. So again, yeah, I made the decision for me and my family. And You get on with it. You push yourself, and that's what I've always done, and that's what I'll always do.
The Walkinshaw era ended, mate, 2017. You spent some time at techno. So you're reunited with people along the way, with James Courtney at Walkinshaw, who you'd been with a couple of times before. Techno Will Davison was there. Couldn't get away from some of these guys. They're like bad smells. No matter where you go, they turn up, or they're where you walk in a door. But and then obviously the Supercars gig. I think it was 18 or 19. You started that.
19, end of 18, wasn't it?
Yeah, end of 18. Yeah. It probably feels like it's been about 10 years in that role, because you've got everyone at you now in that that role, rather than being in Teamland where you're worried about your one bit of a patch. But we've got a bunch of questions which I want to race through from our some of our readers. There's some crackers in among them. But I'll quickly, too, you have been known to wear some Lycra in your time, Burjo, but for good reason. Tour de Cure, tell me more how you got involved in it. Why you do it? I mean, a lot of people hear about it, but they don't quite know what it is. Can you give us the idiot's guide to Tour de Cure?
Yeah, look, I've always been a bit of a keen cyclist. Never that great. I'm not the fittest person. I'm probably carrying 10 kgs or more than I need to. But 2019, my wife passed away of cancer after a very short 4-month illness. Me and my daughter sort of said, right, we need to do something. You know, this life isn't just about us. There's a lot going on out there that we need to be helping where we can. So the pair of us, and my daughter said she was going to do a marathon, and I said, right, I'm going to go and do the Tour de Cure. I'd seen it for years. Obviously knew Brett's fairly well, and I'd watched it. So we tried to do that for the start of 2020, and then COVID arrived. And then towards the end of 2020, my good friend and our good friend and pit lane good friend in Campbell Campbell Little was diagnosed with cancer. So it just made even more sense why we're doing it and why we do these things. And for me, it's become something I'm very passionate about. I'm going to carry on doing it for the next 10 years, because I think you need to have purpose in your life. And if you can do something to help a charity like that, I mean, everyone's touched by cancer. I challenge anyone, over the age of bloody 10 to say they don't know anyone that hasn't been affected by it. It's a very terrible disease, and those guys need all the support they can. So Tour de Cure does an amazing job. I think on the tour that we did in March, we raised over $2.5 million collectively throughout the whole organization, and I raised $27,000, which I'm very happy about. I'm glad I played my part. It was a crazy week emotionally, mentally, and physically. It's one of the hardest things I've ever done, but you get to the end of it and you feel like you've achieved something. And I wanted to do that for my ex-wife, and I wanted to do that for Campbell and for everybody else out there that's suffering and going through tough times or has been affected by it. So yeah, it's tough. It was, there was a lot of tears shed that week, but I'm glad I did it.
I guess it's proof further underlining with what we've heard this year with John Bow, with Cromley, that as cool as all the race car stuff is, it kind of pales into insignificance against, what Campbell's been going through and all these people that, as you said, there's no one over the age of 10 who doesn't know someone directly, someone indirectly, who some way, shape or form knows someone who's been affected by this. So it's a little bit of a life lesson to underline that all that stuff we've talked about of Formula One and supercars and winning championships and world championships, it's cool, it's great, it's amazing, but it's meaningless without the spirit of life to go with it and underpin it all.
100%. Unfortunately, cancer doesn't discriminate. It doesn't. You don't know what's coming. You don't know what's on the agenda for yourself or your family. And it was a good, for me mentally, it was just a good thing to go and do for, for Jean and for my mum. My mum died of cancer when I was 20, and for everyone else. I got so much out from it. I'd learnt a lot about myself doing it. And, I'll continue to support that great charity. And, we're trying to do as much as we can. We're trying to help Campbell at the moment with something that, he's on a tough slog, and Claire and the girls there, they're doing it tough, and those guys need support. And, for me, I'm more than happy giving some time and effort and energy to help the Tour de Cure family. And it was great. But I'll do it again next year. Let's hope we can make a difference between us.
Absolutely. And it actually leads really nicely into our National Motor Racing Museum Couch Racer Questions, the museum up at Mount Panorama, who do an amazing job with the history of the sport. They're open 6 days a week. Don't go on Tuesdays, Burjo. The doors are closed. They're not there. They're there every other day, but not on Tuesdays. If you want the details, head to their Facebook page. But they support our Couch Racer Questions segment. First question is from a Mr. G. Jacobson of Shepparton, who I think might drive a supercar.
Well, I recognise that, mate.
Yeah, I've heard of him. Mr. Gary, his name is. Who's going to do Tour de Cure with you next year, is his question.
I'm certainly hoping that Gary himself will be doing it. And Jono Webb has been a huge supporter of the Tour de Cure family over the years, so I'm hoping John will do it. And now's my chance to get it on record. Bairdo has said he's coming. Craig Hastings said he's coming. Vince from our office said he's coming. And, you know, I'm trying to talk Nick Percan and a few of those guys who are keen cyclists into coming and trying to build a bit more of a V8 supercar sort of family. Obviously, we're aligned with Seven and Warbo and his crew there, so they televise it. So there's some good synergies there. I believe we can, as a family, as a community of supercars, we can do some good work there. A lot of it's going to depend on the calendar. I don't know where we're going to be racing or when yet next year, but Jeff Coombs has shared with me the route next year, and it's going to be a challenge, but hey, you got to do it. So yeah, hopefully Gary's coming.
All right, we'll pencil him in anyway. The next question, we'll race through these, mate. You've been great with your time. I want to let you go. Darren Wilkes, what's been the best engineered race car that you've worked on? Oh. It's got to be a McLaren, surely.
Yeah, it wouldn't be one I engineered, put it that way. But look at the Giorgio Ascanelli or James Robertson, those guys, and Senna and McLaren. It's awesome time. Actually, Adrian, when Adrian turned up at McLaren, you just saw a difference straight away. And that's what the guy is, a bloody legend. You know, everything he touches turns to trophies.
Mm, yeah. Daniel Cottrell asks, we kind of did cover this. What did RD say when you told him you were going to HRT? Do I have to get the bleeper out here?
There's a little bit of a stutter and a few expletives. Wasn't easy doing it. I don't like letting people down. And, you know, for a while I felt like I did, but equally then you've got to remind yourself why you did it. It was about me and not about Roland. So,
David Gear, who works in the pit lane at Erebus, he's from your homeland, I believe. You can paint some more to this. Is it legal to have barbecue sauce on a cooked breakfast, or does it have to be HP?
It's illegal to have barbecue sauce. I mean, one of the things, I've been a proud pom. I've taken some flack for that, which is fine. I don't mind that, but it's got to be Her Majesty's HP sauce. Auntie Liz has HP sauce. She's 98. God bless her.
It's worked for her. It's working well.
It's a proven winner. It's got to be HP sauce.
Are you an Australian resident citizen? Are you still a pom? What are you these days?
I've got both. I've had the pork pie removed and the Chico roll inserted.
Right.
I have the full Aussie passport.
Lovely.
Obviously, I keep the Pommy passport as well, so I'm a citizen.
So you just pick whichever team's winning in the Ashes of the World Cup or anything like that?
Yeah. Fortunately, it's the Aussies for the last few years, but you're exactly right.
You're a fair-weather sailor. This is another question. I think this is from Pit Lane 2. Mr. B. Ryan from Dandenong in Melbourne. Why are you so grumpy?
It's normally because I've just come out of his garage and he's got a sock on about something. That's it. Life would be easy without team owners and race teams, but you know, that's what I get paid to do. So it's normally Baz bleating on about something that we've done wrong. So that's why I'm normally grumpy.
Okay. There you have it answered. Luke Batterson. I always get this wrong. Luke does send in some good questions every now and then. How close was Wink Up to running out of fuel at Bathurst in 2012?
Probably the same as every other year. Look, I take my hat off to him. To be fair, this is a complicated answer. It's Bathurst, God's sake. Everything is on the table. No one cares who finished second. And I fully get it. I get both sides of the garage. It's tough when you're on the team side and you're saying, guys, you know, you're looking at the telemetry and you're saying, you have got nothing spare here. And those guys, Couchy and Dutto and Andrew Edwards and all the engineers up and down pit lane do a cracking job. They run those things so close. I think The year we won it, I think we drained the fuel out and there was something like 200 millilitres. It was less than a can of Coke left in the thing. And that's what you have to do to win the big race. And J-Dub, I get it. He's not bothered. If he fails, if he runs, he doesn't care. And that's the winning mentality. He just wants to win it. And he'll do everything he can. Unfortunately, sometimes on the team are trying to pull him back a little bit. You know, he knows what engineers are like. He knows that we'll always keep a 1% in our back pocket. Well, on that day, Jamie wanted to use that 1% because he knew we'd be being conservative. Well, you know, unfortunately, they've had it, cut it that close. He's paid the price, but then equally he's had the success with it because of his approach. So,
Win some, exactly. Lose some.
Yeah, exactly.
Rob Kingston, what was your favourite livery of the HRT 2015 season? There was the Black Test Day livery, the launch, the regular one, the Star Wars one, the Townsville HRT Brock Retro, the 25-year one. What was your pick? I love a livery question. They're always good.
Yeah, you know what? The Brocky Townsville was pretty cool.
True.
And the Camo. Oh, no, Camo was wrong too.
Yeah, other team. That was the other mob. That was the other mob a couple of years earlier. Well, that was good, though. That was very good. That was very good. Matt Sundy, Insta handle, 2010 DJR. When did you make the decision to leave DJR?
I think I had to tell Dick at Bathurst, which is, you know, not exactly the nicest place to tell someone you're leaving. But I needed to give him 3 months' notice. So, yeah, Bathurst is the answer to that.
Okay. There you go. To round out, it's our V8 Sleuth Top 10 Shootout. You've seen many a shootout in your time. I don't know if you've listened to any of our pods over the journey, Burjo, but basically it's fancy word association. So I name something, you give me the first word that comes in your head. We'll let you have two words. By the end of it, you should be down to one. You should be into the swing. But I'll let you have a few if you need, okay?
Go for it.
You look really nervous here. This could go either way. Mika Häkkinen.
Legend.
And you can't repeat the answer, by the way, for someone else. You got to. You can't call everyone a legend and get out of this one that easily. Adelaide Grand Prix.
Incredible event.
Ayrton Senna.
Can I have a few words? Can I say Tina Turner? Yeah. Simply the best.
Oh, nice. He's got a Tina Turner reference in. It's very 1989. But
number one well, fan.
Are you?
Not really. I'm just
taking right. It sounded good.
I used legend too early. You know,
you've spent your pennies. You spent your pennies too early. James Courtney.
Yeah. Very talented.
I thought you were going to say concussed then, but you didn't go there.
Yeah, still in concussion.
Roland Dane.
Supreme. He's a force to be reckoned with.
Jamie Wincup.
Time. He's the GOAT. You can't take that away from him. He's the GOAT.
120 something reasons why.
Exactly.
Race wins. Ryan Walkinshaw.
Yeah. Good up and comer. I mean, we use him more than one word.
You are.
Tough. He's following in some incredible footsteps. But he's doing a good job. Look at the team this year. The success they're having is, he's turning it around. So, yeah, respect.
Respect. Aye.
And his mate.
Yes, Martine, for those who...
She's the star as well.
Ron Dennis.
Yeah, I've used all the words I want to use.
Yeah.
just inspirational.
There you go. See, you had another gear to go to when you needed to go to it. Two to come, Bathurst.
Exhilarating. It's just a challenge. It's like doing the Le Mans 24-hour and winning that. It's hard, tough. There's so many great. I've got another good story about that, but yeah.
Oh, which one?
Oh, Le Mans.
What about Le Mans?
Oh, God. When I was with Trevor, when we were doing the Renault World Series season, Andrew Gilbert Scott, who was Takuma Sato's manager, invited me and Trev to go to Rickard to go and do a 24-hour test with Team Go because they needed some help and they needed a team manager. So we're down in Rickard and Andrew asked us if we wanted to go to Le Mans with them and help them. So I went and did a test with them. And then the calendar fell. I was racing in Barcelona the weekend before with my team and Jerez the weekend after Le Mans with my team. And we were running second in the championship. We were winning races. We were up against Kovalainen for the win. And Trev said, I can't go. I'm not going. If you want to go and do it. And, I put Trevor and our team first. And I said to Andrew, I said, I can't do it. I'd love to go, but I can't go. We're too busy with our stuff. And then didn't worry about it. Saturday night, Saturday afternoon, race starts. One lap in. I can't remember who was, but stuck it in the gravel. And they've got Christensen, Ronald Capelli, and Soji Arria as the drivers. Good drivers.
And this is the Audi R8, the dominant the car R8, of the time. Yeah,
that's the one, yeah. So they dropped it in the gravel and went a lap down, first lap. So I thought, okay, fine, made the right call. Went to bed, like midnight, 11 o'clock. I'm watching it a little bit. They're back on the lead lap. They're like three quarters of a lap down. I thought, that's fine. Get up in the morning, and they're like quarter of a lap down, and they won the bloody race outright. All right, outright. So I just turned down the chance to be team manager of the Le Mans 24-hour race winning, outright race winning, not class, Audi R8 with Tom Christensen, who's just the, endurance racing. He's the GOAT, I mean, going back to earlier, that is one regret I've got in my motor racing career that I didn't take up the chance to go and do it.
Yeah. Woulda, coulda, shoulda.
That's the only one that I feel like, shit, I made the wrong choice there. Anyway, we digress.
Yeah, it is what it is. One more to come in the top 10 shootout, Dick Johnson.
Oh, legend. Just top bloke. All round top bloke.
Hard to argue with that one. Yeah, mate, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for your time, mate. I know we've chewed up a fair bit of it. Enjoy the red. I'm sorry that we, because of COVID, couldn't be in Queensland sitting in the same room having a chin wag about some of this stuff. But an amazing journey, amazing achievements, amazing memories, and I'm sure you've got plenty more left to do in your motorsport career. Thanks for sitting down and having a chat with us. And we look forward to seeing what happens in the next years, decades, centuries. You had a few more chapters along the way. Good stuff.
Thanks, Nance. Thanks for your effort into our what I can call a community or a family. We've got an incredible series here with supercars. It really is the best touring car created category in the world. We've got an exciting era in Gen 3 coming. Everyone's very passionate about it. That's why everyone's vocal about it. But we've got a great series. You guys do a great job. The fans just need to stick with us. You're going to enjoy it. I can't wait to get there. It's going to be great racing with great cars. Stick with it. Thanks a lot, boys and girls.
There you have it. A big thank you to ATB for taking some time. We were supposed to do it in person. Unfortunately, COVID scenario in Melbourne meant that it was a bit difficult for me to get to Queensland. In fact, impossible for me to get to Queensland at the time that we'd arranged. So Zoom was our next best friend, but it was great to sit down, hear some stories that I'd never heard before. A couple of old faithful favourite ones that I've probably heard over the years, but you might not have heard. I think that there was something for just about everybody in that podcast. Thank you to everyone who sent some notes after part one, who really appreciated that one. I think part two was great as well. A big thank you again to Adrian Burgess for his time and sharing his amazing motorsport story. Don't forget, head to our website, bhsleuth.com.au. We've got content all the time flowing through. Our online bookshop is humming. We're on the build up to Father's Day, Christmas, Bathurst. There's pre-order books. There's a bunch of stuff that's coming out very soon. There's a bunch of stuff that's just come out. Make sure you check back to that website, bookshop.bhsleuth.com.au. Follow us on the socials. You know where to find us. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Join the masses. There's heaps there. They're on board. Get on board too and be a part of this community that we've got of motorsport history and heritage. It's something really, really cool. Hope you've enjoyed part two of our chat with Adrian Burgess. Remember, Repco Supercars Weekly is every Tuesday. Next Wednesday, we'll have another guest on the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Repco. Chat to you then.